troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here again. Kevin, always a pleasure. How are you?
Doing wonderfully and having a good time as the stories gravitate away from COVID, finally.
Yes. Yes. As thrilled as I am to talk about that same subject over and over, I think it's good to spread the scientific wealth, if you will. But looking forward to it. Oh, and by the way, before we jump into the stories this week, we are officially on iTunes and Spotify, everybody. So subscribe, write a review. Kevin and I are very fragile, and so we need your validation in order to keep doing the show.
Well, and also the beautiful part about this is that when you tell people about a podcast that you like, there's so many podcasts and so much media right now. And helping people find what they're really interested in is so important. There's people who find the podcast I do, Talking Biotech. We've been doing it for 5 years, 240 episodes, and people are just finding it now saying, where has this been all my life? And, you know, there's a Cinderella moment out there for everyone, and I think there's definitely a foot for science, facts, and fallacies.
Absolutely. And you know, now that you mentioned that, that's pretty much how I found every podcast is someone goes, hey, have you heard the blah, blah, blah show? And then I go listen to it and it is really, really good. And if I humbly say so, I think this show's pretty good. So anyway, let's jump into the stories we're going to talk about. So first up, a former FDA researcher says the agency needs to speed its COVID-19 vaccine approval process. The EPA has approved a GMO mosquito trial for Florida this summer. But the question arises, should we be worried about these genetically engineered bugs flying around? And next up, a year-long investigation shows that anti-GMO groups aren't the grassroots independent watchdogs that they claim to be. And finally, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker want to ban factory farming, quote unquote. And I find this phrasing very frustrating, but we're actually going to explain why this proposal is not a great idea. But first up, Kevin, let's talk about this article by Henry Miller in the Wall Street Journal about why we can't have bureaucratic foot dragging when it comes to a COVID vaccine.
Yeah, so this is commentary by Dr. Henry Miller, and he restates the very clear concept that a vaccine will be the cornerstone for getting beyond COVID-19. And it's going to be necessary, but experts are saying 12 to 18 months. Realistic experts are saying probably longer. And really, there are ways to speed that because the strategic toilet paper reserve will not make it that long, right? So, there are ways that we can potentially speed that. And so Dr. Miller goes into that in terms of how you can cut corners, but without cutting safety. And with 78 different vaccines in development, I've heard 90, I've heard 110. How can we relieve some of the bottlenecks that slow the testing and then ultimately the production of the vaccine? And that's what the article is really about.
What I found really, really interesting, and I think he left this on a comment in response to the article. I don't know if it's in the body of the text, but he actually said that the FDA itself is skeptical of these sorts of changes because they are very conservative. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? In a situation that we're in, do you think they should be a little more open to these kinds of policy changes?
Well, the FDA is appropriately conservative, with a little c. You know, they don't want to make a mistake, and they do make mistakes. You know, we've seen it in so many different places where, you know, medicines that have been approved have later shown to be problematic. And in many cases, you know, Vioxx, a whole bunch of examples where things really weren't done correctly. And it's simply because this is challenging science. You're dealing with physiology, differences in people. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. So they take this very precautionary approach to validation and approval of vaccines. And one of the things I learned from the article is that only 16% of vaccine applications ultimately result in an accepted vaccine. So what he's talking about are, what are the ways that we can accelerate the process and how can we get beyond that? And that was really the crux of the article. Are there places where we can make it go faster still while being safe?
So let's talk about a couple of the examples, because they were really interesting. I mean, most of them, I think, are pretty common sense. But one of the things he talked about was unblinding the trials, so the researchers understand how patients are reacting to the vaccine earlier. Can you elaborate on what that means, Kevin?
Well, many of the trials, or most trials, are done in a double-blind fashion, where either the researcher and the patient, the person in the clinical trial, have no idea what is being delivered, whether it's a medicine or a placebo. And this way, there's no tells coming from the researcher. There's no influence that may be given subtly as someone knows that they're delivering a placebo or a treatment, or, you know, they're both giving a treatment, a placebo or an active medication. Both have a treatment effect, you know, for what it's worth. But if you don't know what you're delivering, you're not sensitive to changes that you may notice in the patient. So if you're giving somebody consistently the placebo or the actual active ingredient, you may pick up on certain things that you see as a trained observer, as a trained clinician, to say, okay, every time I'm seeing this, they're reporting sleep problems or numbness in their fingers or, you know, their hair falling out. If you don't have an unblinded test, you would miss that. And while blinding is so critical in objective studies, in the case of a vaccine, getting it through, getting it approved, these may be more valuable to be administered as unblinded trials.
Very, very interesting. And one other, there's several, but I just want to go over a couple of them. One of the other interesting ones was reciprocity with other agencies across the globe. So if a developed nation, like say the UK or the states in the European Union, if they develop a vaccine and they test it and it appears to be safe, then the FDA could, I guess, theoretically go, okay, well, then it's good enough for the United States too. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think so. But the big problem there is that a lot of these countries, or most of the ones that you think of, tend to have more onerous regulation than we do. And I can't think of any examples, and I'm not an expert in those areas. But for instance, if New Zealand, for whatever reason, had their approval process be extremely rigorous and solid, yet be a little more streamlined and faster, then we may be inclined to accept their approval as our own. And we do this with other drugs and other vaccines. The yellow fever virus, their yellow fever vaccine is hard to get these days in the States. And I know when I went to Uganda, I had to receive a UN or a European Union accepted one that didn't go through the same rigor of approval, yet was still with consent, something that I could receive. And even though the FDA and US agencies never approved it, it was by someone who's probably pretty good. So, you know, let's give it a whirl. And they were very clear about the potential associated risks. And I was like, cool, rolled up my sleeve, let's go to Uganda, you know, give me a shot. So I think there is something very good about this reciprocity idea.
Yeah, certainly. And one of his recommendations, I'm guessing this is going to be the most controversial, is the idea that you test at-risk populations after the vaccine is actually approved. And I'm talking about, you know, the elderly or young children, you know, I mean, these are the populations that can have a serious reaction to vaccines more frequently than like a healthy adult can. And I think what he's saying is, well, if we can show that it's safe for the general population, then let's test it in these people afterwards. What do you think of that? It seems like that could be kind of scandalous potentially.
Well, I understand how that can be misinterpreted, but what Dr. Miller is pointing to is the idea that if you go to a population that has reasonable fitness, that's not having likely comorbidities, that's exhibiting general fitness, and also a diversity of genetics that would potentially display or uncover subtle, or should say, would not be influenced by subtle genetic differences, because a wider swatch would give you a good statistical mean. You could get large numbers and you show that it's safe and that you're not having any problems. Then you could start to work in these populations where there may be something that can crop up. And so start with the larger population first, show that it is or is not safe and efficacious, and then move to these other populations. And I think that is a very good point.
Yeah. Okay. So that actually makes quite a bit of sense after you explain it that way. So, just in passing, I wonder if there's a case to be made for modifying the FDA's policies. I know you said just a few minutes ago that they have to be conservative to make sure they're protecting public health, but I mean, these seem very logical. So, I mean, someone else will have to make that determination, not you or me, but it seems like you could make a case for that.
Well, going forward, I think it's going to happen. These are rules that were really set down throughout the 1960s and 70s, most likely, right? So we are living at a time where we know that technology is outpacing our ability to regulate it, right? We need to have newest technology faster. And especially in response to a global pandemic, this needs to go quicker. And I think that's what we're ultimately going to learn from this entire episode.
Well, here's hoping that the vaccine gets here soon and that it works, because I mean, as you said, there's no guarantee. But let's move on to something that's probably equally controversial, and that is the EPA approving a genetically engineered mosquito, which is designed to suppress Zika virus and dengue, I believe. And the trial is set for Florida, so your neighborhood, Kevin, and it's supposed to take place this summer. So introduce the technology behind this mosquito, and then what are your thoughts just as a Floridian?
Well, the technique is something that actually is very old. It's called the sterile insect technique. And what the idea is that if you produce sterile males, that you can suppress a population because they'll be out in the population mating with females but shooting blanks and essentially occupying that ecological niche and occupying those females so that fertile males are not occupying those females. And the idea is that it suppresses population numbers. And historically, this has been done by subjecting mosquitoes to large doses of radiation or chemistry that would render them sterile. And then they release them, they go out and do their thing without really doing their thing. They don't get to increase the population numbers. Now, Oxitec, a company in England, has really put a very sharp point on this otherwise blunt tool. And what they do is they raise mosquitoes in the laboratory with a gene that causes lethality. Only in the laboratory, you can turn that gene off by growing the mosquito larvae in the presence of a chemical. And I believe it's tetracycline. I don't know their technology. It's proprietary. But there are ways that you can turn that gene off in the water where these larvae are being reared. And then as they mature, that gene is off because it's not active in the adult. But now when that adult goes out and mates, now anything that it gives rise to contains that lethal gene without the tetracycline or without the repressor. So in other words, those larvae never can develop. So it's basically the male, going back to the whole process, the male in the laboratory can survive as a larvae and can pass on and then grow up to be an adult, pass on its genes, but can't survive in the wild. And so what you see when they've tested this, and they've done it in Brazil and other places, the mosquito levels crash. They don't go to zero, but they crash. And it is a very effective way to limit the technology, the spread of the mosquito. And you ask, you know, my neighborhood, well, it's actually in the Keys. That's, you know, 10 hours away. So Florida is a huge state. It's about 8 to 10 hours away. Nonetheless, if Zika or dengue was happening actively in the small burg of Archer, Florida, I would love to have this technology deployed.
It's kind of like here in California, everybody thinks I surf and I don't know what other cliches, you know. I live in San Francisco and
hey, go to Disney every day. Drive over to Tijuana.
Yeah. I know celebrities, me and Leo DiCaprio have beers together. It's all, yeah, absolutely. So to get back to the mosquito, what I'm wondering is, are there any legitimate concerns about this technology? Because people are throwing things out like you're going to increase antibiotic resistance because tetracycline is an antibiotic, but that doesn't make sense to me because you're not giving it to them. That's how that's the catch, right? Is you release them and you don't give them this chemical they need, so they can't reproduce, you know? So it seems like that's backwards to me, but are there any concerns that are valid in your mind?
No, all of the concerns on this I've levied a long time ago because I thought, well, you know, purple martins and bats and stuff thrive on mosquitoes. They require mosquitoes as part of their diet. They fill this ecological niche. But these are Aedes aegypti. These are mosquitoes that are invasive. They don't belong here in the first place. And they can, and the numbers also don't go to zero. They just go very low. So the risk in terms of an ecological hazard is extremely minimal.
You know, and I've seen several studies now that have been done over the last few years. And what they show, from what I remember, is that when you explain this technology to people, and then I think they showed them a video of it or something, but once they understand what you're doing with it, that you're trying to eradicate these invasive bugs that spread really dangerous diseases, people go, oh, that makes sense. Okay, I'm not as scared now. And so I think we're ending up in a situation where you have those activist groups that are never going to be convinced. But then the general public, once they get an understanding, they tend to back off. They go, okay, well, this is good for me.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that during a pandemic, the public may also be a little more malleable and a little more accepting of technology to solve a problem. And to me, having this in our queue so that when Zika or dengue or chikungunya or any of these mosquito-transmitted diseases become very firmly footed in Florida, we have a quick response. And, you know, people are seeing Zika in Miami and in, you know, these other urban centers not too many years ago, and you still have to have trucks full of insecticide going through the streets, spraying, aerial spraying, to suppress mosquito numbers, to limit Zika presence. And this is a much, much better solution. I would much rather have mosquitoes self-limiting themselves than have to have chemical controls that can have collateral effects on pollinators and other insects. Let's just go after the ones that are the target by using a genetics that is honed to target the target.
Boom. Beat that. Activist. Well,
I'll arm wrestle anyone on that one any day. I think this is something I think is so critical. And if we can demonstrate proof of concept here in Florida, let's start going for larger populations to stop malaria and these other diseases that kill millions. I mean, this is really an important thing. So
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point, because it's kind of a risk because it's not like, you know, we don't release this and life goes on and everything's great. I mean, there is a real problem to solve. So that's something to keep in mind. But speaking of the anti-GMO activists, the Genetic Literacy Project has undertaken a year-long investigation to find out how these different activist groups are funded, where they're getting money from, where they spend money, who they work with, you know, who are they connected with. And so I think we're just trying to ruin everybody's day by releasing this thing. But Kevin, why don't you weigh in, since, again, you were an expert, but, you know, seeing this from the outside.
Well, you know, I've personally felt the pain of their investment. You know, these are folks who are walking around with a halo that really is more like a noose. You know, who really owns them? And there are a lot of organizations out there that say that they're the advocates for the little guy, the friends of the environment and the earth, and standing up for the small guy. And really, they are the ones who have the money and control of the media and the message. And, you know, they've gone on for years saying that scientists who are legitimately just sharing the peer-reviewed literature and talking about the science, its strengths and weaknesses, you know, the big bad scientists like me that are, you know, the just puppets of corporate overlords, right? They're the same folks who are making claims about factory farms. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's one of these things where the argument has always been that the scientists who are out talking about science are just tools of Big Ag. And, you know, it was written in the New York Times in 2015, you know, about me. He's on the inner circle of lobbyists, PR experts, and executives, you know, which has never panned out. I mean, I'm just a schlub scientist who likes to talk about science. It turns out that when you look at who is the real David and Goliath, and I guess I was wondering today, like, if you named your kid Goliath, he's probably going to be trouble. Because, I mean, imagine you'd be like getting wedgies all the way through kindergarten, you know, and make you turn out the way you turn out. But if who is really the Goliath in this equation? And is it Big Ag or is it the anti-GMO movement? Who is it really?
Right. Well, let me spoil the surprise and let me say that it is the activist groups. And the way we know that is we dug through their annual reports and we dug through the tax documents that they release publicly. And they're not required to release everything, but we went through everything that we could get our hands on. And what we found is that over the period 2012 to 2016, these groups got a total of almost $1 billion in donations from these wealthy private charities, these family foundations, and then, of course, from the organic food industry. And so when you compare that to what biotech companies spend on lobbying, it doesn't even compare. And of course, Bayer and Monsanto, these companies lobby because everybody does. They're trying to protect their business interest. But I think the myth is that you have these independent, well-meaning activist groups. They're just blowing the whistle on the bad guys. And in reality, they have a huge, huge supply, you know, huge donations behind them. And they're well-coordinated. And you have people that work at one group who are on the board of directors at another group. You know what I mean? So this is a very, very interconnected lattice work of activism that's well-funded. So I think we just need to blow the lid off that idea that we're just the little guy. You know, that's a myth.
Yeah, well, the part that really bothers me is that there's a lot of organizations that do really good work that I really appreciate. And when you look at the Sierra Club, even Greenpeace, you know, these are organizations that were founded on a really important mission and a really important ideal. And I would love to support. But at the same time, they're engaged in activities that are directly in opposition to their stated mission. And that is helping the environment, maybe helping the poor or whatever. That's really the conundrum here is here's organizations that I would love to love, yet they're doing something that is working counter to what I'm trying to do as a professional scientist, which is share the legitimate science.
Yeah. And one thing that was most fascinating as we were going through this is that there's a lot of these foundations that fund these groups. Ostensibly, they're pro-science. They give money to museums and education programs. They fund original research, but then they also give money to these same groups. And I mean, and these are, you know, Kevin was kind of joking earlier about being picked on, but these are the groups that go pick up, try to get Kevin's emails and publish them online. And then they try to didn't somebody try to publish your credit card information, your address at some point a couple of years ago?
Oh God, no, they actually have put all of my retirement information, all of, like anything I owned in terms of stocks or mutual funds, all of that went online. My bank account information went online. I mean, it's basically everything's a freaking open book. That's why I just put money in my mattress now and live under a viaduct, because basically I've been driven into troll-like existence. But it really is a very invasive thing. And this is what, when you send money to the Sierra Club or to Greenpeace, you're funding going after me. And which, you know, which is fine. You know, if you feel like I'm a problem, great. But it just is so important for you to understand the scope of the people you donate to. And it drives me nuts because I'll be at the grocery store register and they'll say like, hey, you want to give a dollar to kids with cancer? And I'll go like, no, I don't. Because, you know, and I sound like such a jerk. But I really don't know the organization that they're, giving it to. And I would hate to be able to, I'd hate to learn that the money that I was giving is going to fund some anti-vaccination group or something really bad that's hiding behind the guise of children with a terminal disease. So research the people you give to very carefully.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And one thing I found most fascinating, and to their credit, a lot of these groups will tell you that they do this, but the Sierra Club, for example, they have a whole nother organization that is legally allowed to lobby in Washington. And it's called the, I think it's called the Sierra Club Foundation. But they basically say, you know, we at one point in our history, the IRS said we were engaging in lobbying, and so we weren't allowed to do that. So we just set up this other organization that collects donations and engages in lobbying. And so technically they're right when they say, you know, we don't engage in politics. We just were in the outreach and the education business. But by the way, we have this whole other side of our operation that does indeed do lobbying, you know? And so I just find that disingenuous that they will blast Bayer or they will blast Syngenta for being involved in politics. All the while, so are they, but they get away with it. And so that's one of the reasons that we release this.
Well, the Sierra Club also, they sue universities over their guidance on things like fertilizers. I know probably a decade ago now that, you know, the university I work for does a very good job at being very conservative about their guidance on how to fertilize lawns, golf courses, whatever, because we're very concerned about the fragile environment of the state. And after years of careful analysis, published research came out, and the Sierra Club sued the university because they said this is bad guidance. And here you are as a university doing your best to represent the public and going under the bus and having to spend huge amounts of public money to defend a scientific perspective and defend the data against an organization that allegedly should be working in the public's best interest in concert with university scientists.
Right. And as we wrap up, I just want to make one point. We released this project a little over a week ago now, so it's still very early, but thus far we haven't heard any reaction from any of these groups, just dead silence. And in my experience, and Kevin, maybe you can comment on this too, but my experience is that if they think they can respond to you or shut down what you're saying, then they will attack you. So for example, I've gotten emails from certain individuals who will remain unnamed, taking issue with a minor typo in my article or something. And they'll say, oh, so you're not interested in the truth because you made a dumb mistake. But meanwhile, when you release a huge thing like this, they say nothing, you know, and to me, that's the silence is deafening, as the cliche goes, because I think if there was something they could say, they would respond.
Absolutely. The big trick now is how do you get the people who trust these organizations to look at this kind of activity objectively? And that's our job as communicators and as the listeners to this kind of audience, thinking about, or the audience of this kind of podcast, to bring attention to the roles of these organizations and how, you know, the money that you spend on that middle of the night TV ad isn't necessarily going to something that is working for you. And look at where you send your money very carefully and use this tool on the GLP website as a way to provide that guidance.
Yep, please do. Please do, because the biggest thing is getting people informed about it. So yes, check it out. But moving on to our final story, let's talk about Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker, both U.S. senators, who are attempting to institute a factory farming, quote unquote, ban by 2040. So again, Kevin, just like our story last week with Stephanie Seneff, I'm just going to bash my head on the table while you explain.
Well, do you have a friend who is somebody who will tell you something that maybe you don't want to hear? Like, you know, somebody who you trust, who's like, you know, some real tough love kind of person. You know, like you aren't going to really wear that, are you?
My wife.
Yeah. You know, it's a good example. I think all the time about when I was in college and, you know, we were going to go out goofing off or whatever. And, you know, I'd come out and like some kind of something that I found at a thrift shop and something, you're not going to wear that, are you? And so there are people sometimes that are the closest to us who can give us the best criticism of our failed wardrobe, or in some cases, legislation. and that's really how I feel about this, because I'm on board with Senator Warren and Booker on so many issues, but not with their response to agriculture. And I feel that ideas like this go so far in alienating a critical part of the population that they need to court in order to win elections and change important policy, change things like, you know, maintain things like the Supreme Court, all that kind of stuff. You know, without getting political, they are alienating a substantial portion of the population that may not be thrilled with current leadership, but sees it as the lesser of two evils. And now here's a group of people who are going after my livelihood. To me, it drives me nuts, because what's wrong? And when they use factory farm as a term of derision, a really disparaging term, but we make our cell phones in factories. We make our cars in factories. Factory means that you can scale it up and be efficient and create a product that the consumer can afford. And so I'm not against factory farms.
Right. And you shouldn't be. And you gave a couple examples, but just to make it more absurd, you know, why should we be opposed to factory shoemaking and factory medication production and, you know, factory toilet paper, you know, like it's so outrageous to say that, you know, if you scale up production, if you do it on a large scale, well, then it must be bad. And I don't think, you know, what I suspect is, and maybe I'm a little cynical, I suspect, as you mentioned, that this is a sort of pandering. Because if this thing was to pass, it would immediately say no new quote unquote factory farms can open immediately. And then by 2040, the ones that are open have to shut down, you know? So, I mean, this would be a dramatic change in how we produce food in this country. And so I don't think it's going to pass. I don't think they think it's going to pass, but at the same time, they can propose it and then they can turn around to their donors and their voter base and say, look, I'm a champion for the little farmer. You know, I'm getting tired of politics is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. But think how insane this is. And I'll just read this quote. For years, regulators looked the other way while giant multinational corporations crushed competition in agriculture sector and seized control of key markets. Now that's what Elizabeth Warren said. Now let's replace the word agriculture with mobile communications, with banking, with automobiles, computers, with media, you know, and or with politicians. You know, it's the ones who have deep pockets and the ones who are the gigantic, you know, cabal of their parties who are the ones who are able to advance. And so the idea of scale is something that brings affordability and access to technology or to food or to automobiles or banking or whatever. It's because you can create it larger, you can do it cheaper, and it gives more people access. And sure, someone makes a buck in the process. You don't want to necessarily put the reins on that. And they're talking about mostly ending the large feedlots, the concentrated feedlots, the CAFOs. And that is a place where beef is finished. So all over Florida, they're out here grazing. You know, we're one of the biggest cattle producing states in terms of grazing cattle. And then they go to these CAFOs for finishing, where they eat a lot of corn and soy, they fatten them up, and then they use them to go from there for slaughter. And that's what they want to end. It's they say it's broken. They say the food system is broken. The CAFOs are a part of it. But let the market sort that out. And right now, during this whole COVID thing, we're starting to see some of the vulnerabilities to that kind of large factory system that may spawn offshoots naturally and efficiencies and profit centers where smaller people can profit and survive. So the market will take care of itself.
Yeah. Two final things to follow up with, and you can close this out with your little fortune cookie nuggets of wisdom. But it's funny to me that they're making this case that, you know, you're robbing consumers of a choice because you have this, you know, this monopoly or this oligopoly in this market. And so their solution is, we're going to smash all the guys we don't like, and then the guys we do like are going to take over. So there, same choice, you know. So I find that a little ridiculous that, you know, to increase competition, we're going to knock out the competition that we don't like. And then the fact that they're using a crisis where there are limited food shortages. They're not severe yet, but limited food shortages to enact a policy that could very possibly increase food shortages or at least higher food prices. So it just, everything about this is backwards is what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, because who's going to step in if you eliminate the factory farm? And, you know, I love small producers. You know, I'm married to one. I have friends who are small cattle producers. You know, they have 400 head of cattle up in Alachua, Florida, and Graham Cattle, you know, .com, if you want to check them out. If that's .com, I don't know. But I have small producer friends who are really support. But, you know, if you buy a ribeye from them, it's $20. If you buy three of them over in the shrink wrap aisle over at the grocery store in my town, you know, it's going to be $11.99. And it's because of scale. And certainly the product quality is different. It's a boutique niche product. It's probably better when it comes from my friend than when it comes out of the whole thing. But most people don't want to afford that. And in cases of things like chicken or pork, where it's very inexpensive, it's the scale that allows people to have access to that protein at a low cost. And I think that's something that we probably risk ending if Warren and Booker's idea comes true.
You know, call me a Philistine, but I think the corn-fed stuff is just better than all the the grass-fed and the all-natural and the free-range. And I just like the mass-produced stuff. I think it's delicious. So I'm personally offended by this proposal, Kevin.
Well, I'm on board with that too. I mean, I totally appreciate the reason they make corn-fed beef is because you get more, you get better marbling, you get more, you know, more finishing than you do just with straight grass-fed. It costs money to ship them across the country to corn feed them, and so if it didn't make a difference, probably wouldn't do it. But I am making a prediction. Here's my fortune cookie. Okay, we pop this thing. Every week we should have Kevin's fortune cookie.
Yeah.
I'm predicting that you'll see a resurgence in local butchering. I think that butchers are the next microbrewers, that every town will explode with new sausage makers, new butchers, and somebody who you can bring you can buy a side of beef and bring it to them, and they'll put it in your freezer in the appropriate pieces. It's kind of a lost art form that now that it's been relegated to these giant factories. I guess there's four factories or four slaughterhouses in the U.S. for beef cattle. That, you know, that's kind of thin ice. You know, 85% comes through those four factories, and maybe it's time for meat to start taking on that more boutique feeling, and people will be willing to pay more for something that's locally produced and locally processed.
Yeah. And notice how he said, let's get more competition. Notice I didn't say, let me get my government buddies to take your legs out so you can't sell your product. So, yeah, that's a great point. You know, more competition, prices are forced down, more options, world's a great place. So let's end on that. Kevin, what's up next on Talking Biotech for you?
Really cool stuff. The episode that was published the other day is on Do Masks Matter? And keeping in the theme of the COVID-19 crisis, I speak with an expert on public health about whether wearing a mask actually makes a difference. In the U.S., it's become a political statement, but does it actually help public health? And then coming up on next Saturday, I speak with Vance Crow, a former guy who helps look behind the curtain at Monsanto. What was it and what was his roles? And then also how he thinks communication and science and agriculture can change for the better.
Good stuff. As always, check out the podcast. And you are at Kevin Fulton on Twitter, right? Did I memorize that?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
spelled just like it sounds.
At Kevin Fulton. I am at Cam J English. And just before we go, as I said, we're on Spotify. We're on Twitter. So like us, follow us, give us a review. And if you're feeling so generous, you can donate to the Genetic Literacy Project, which helps us put out free resources like this podcast. Buttons at the very bottom of the article. So click that and give us a buck if you can. And thank you guys so much. We will see you next week.